Admit it. Our public debate has been reduced to reading each other's bumper stickers. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. I made up most of them, and most of those when I was mad as hell about something. So if you hate war, empire, central banking, cops, Republicans, Democrats, gun grabbers, and status of all stripes, go to LibertyStickers.com, and there's a good chance you'll find just what you need for the back of your truck. Own a bookstore? Sell guns at the show? Get the wholesaler's deal. Buy any 100 stickers and they drop down in price to a dollar a piece. You can spread the contempt and make a little money too. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is the Scott Horton Show. I'm live from 11 to 1 Texas time, Monday through Friday at ScottHorton.org and at NoAgendaStream.com, except on Thursdays. Also, you can find me on TalkStreamLive.com, where I'm usually at least in the fourth row. I liked it better when I got up into the second row. Right now, I'm in the fourth row. That's pretty good, though. I'll take it. That's at TalkStreamLive.com if you want to check out the show that way. All right, and now you guys are familiar with the name. I talk about him all the time because it just always seems to come up. David Vine, he's the author of the book Island of Shame, about the United States, United Kingdom conspiracy against the people of the Chagos Archipelago, and especially the island Diego Garcia, where they hold the world hostage with their hydrogen bombers. And anyway, so Island of Shame is such a well-done piece of journalism, and I do hope that you will take a look at it. And like I was telling you earlier on the show, David basically... like Nick Terse, has picked up the cudgels where Chalmers Johnson left off on keeping track of America's empire of bases, our global empire of bases. And I believe, David, it was in your book that I first read the figure pegging the number of American bases outside the United States at over 1,000. Is that correct? And welcome back to the show.
Oh, thanks, Scott. It's just great to be back on the show. Yes, the number of bases overseas is always notoriously difficult to get a handle on. The Pentagon itself doesn't even know for sure how many bases it has outside the 50 states and D.C. Nick Terse, actually, I think, has done the best accounting work, and he put the figure at over 1,100 a couple of years ago. Since then, a significant number of are in the process of closing in Afghanistan, so it's hard to say exactly, but it's probably around 1,000 at least right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was wondering about that, whether this counted the height of the Iraq and Afghan occupations or not.
The 1,100 figure, I believe, didn't count the bases in Iraq, so when those bases were open, the figure probably neared 1,500. At least, but now we're probably somewhere around 1,000, just 1,000.
Wow. So, now, how many countries are there in the world again, and how many countries are these bases in?
That also is challenging to get a handle on, especially because, you know, some of it depends on how you define a base, and the Pentagon plays lots of linguistic games about what is a base and what isn't a base. But there's a U.S. military presence, and I think that's really the most important thing to focus on. Mm-hmm. You know, whether it's formally a U.S. base or it's another base that's hosting U.S. forces, those distinctions matter, of course, in a variety of ways. But I think what's most important to focus on is the U.S. military presence overseas. And there's a U.S. military presence in upwards of 160, 165, maybe 170 countries around the world. And the presence on relatively small deployments to tens of thousands of troops in Germany and Japan and South Korea still to this day. But it is a rather remarkable occupation of countries around the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I know it also depends on how you can't count the various countries that the CIA is breaking off from other countries and that kind of thing, but it's somewhere right around, what, 192 nations in the world?
That's about right, yeah.
I think that's the count at the General Assembly or somewhere right around there. And so, wow, I mean, that really only leaves out Russia, China, and what I guess Mongolia is between the two of them. But we even have bases in Kyrgyzstan, which is, you know, goes to show that even being directly in Russia and or China's backyard is not a reason to that our government would stay out at all. There, you can find them there, too.
No, absolutely. And in many ways, it's precisely a reason to be there for some, for many in the Pentagon and elsewhere in the national security bureaucracy. The U.S. military has large numbers of bases surrounding China and Russia, and has for decades, going back to the Cold War. The number of bases in the Persian Gulf surrounding Iran has gone up dramatically since the beginning of the war in Afghanistan, the war in Iraq. I think we need to turn the tables in our minds, at least, and think how we in the United States would feel if China or Russia established just a single base in Mexico or the Caribbean or anywhere remotely near the United States. I think we know how people in the United States respond. Meanwhile, we literally have hundreds of bases in East Asia and Central Asia surrounding China and Russia.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, you know, it's funny, isn't it, the way, just how effective the narrative is that we're all raised with, where this is perfectly acceptable and you never have to think about the other guy's point of view. Where when the president of Ecuador said, yeah, you can have your military base here as long as we can have a military base in Florida, it was absolutely ridiculous. No one took it seriously for a moment, but no one ever had to. At the same time they were laughing about it, they still didn't really take the point. They're like, wow, what if I was from Ecuador and I really didn't want an American military base? You know, what must it be like for them? You know what I mean? It was silly that they would have a base in Florida, but still not silly that we would have a base there. You know?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And that's why it was so brilliant, a comment by President Correa, to at least force some people in the United States to think about what it would be like to contemplate a foreign base in a place like Miami. It is truly inconceivable to most people in the United States. And meanwhile, we don't think twice about how seemingly natural it is that the United States has bases in hundreds of countries overseas.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and by the way, it's a good question. Hooper in the chat room is asking, what exactly defines a base? Is that just a closet full of guns somewhere, or does there actually have to be some boots, some cots, or what?
It's a great question, and there are many definitions, first of all, and the various services have different names for bases, posts, air bases, air stations, and the like. So I think there are a whole range of kinds of installations and facilities. Some are the sort of city-sized bases, like we see in Ramstein, Germany, or in places in Okinawa, elsewhere in Japan and South Korea. There are relatively small bases with several hundreds of troops in places like Honduras, which is a place where if you go to the base in Honduras, you'll be told firmly by U.S. and Honduran personnel there is no the United States is simply a guest on a Honduran military base, and which is, you know, really something of a fiction. But then there are also there are warehouses. There are some bases are simply warehouses, stockpiling weaponry, materiel, other supplies. So it might just have a handful of military personnel guarding the facility, or often military contractors. There are radar installations that are technically bases. A whole range of kinds of facilities with different functions. So we have to think about the whole breadth of types of bases.
All right. And now, again, everybody, I'm talking with David Vine, the author of the great book Island of Shame. It's about Andrew Jackson's Trail of Tears to Oklahoma, only this time in the Indian Ocean. But otherwise, it's exactly the same morality at work there, and the very same kind of result. Now, you got this piece here, David, at TomDispatch.com. It also ran under Tom's name at antiwar.com. Tom Engelhart, that is. It's called Base World Profiteering. Where has all the money gone? And, you know, that makes me think of Dick Cheney, because wasn't that kind of the deal that he was really bad at running, the oil services company? And he made a bunch of really bad decisions as CEO of Halliburton, like buying a company that was just about to have to settle on an asbestos claim for $1 bazillion and stuff like that. And so he said, don't worry, I'm just going to put you on military welfare and we'll just build army bases around the world from now on, and you'll get a lot of money for free. And that was kind of the deal.
I probably shouldn't comment on the quality of Dick Cheney's leadership as president and CEO of Halliburton, but you're absolutely right that the former, now former Halliburton subsidiary KBR, Kellogg Brown and Root, which was a part of Halliburton when Dick Cheney ran it, has been the major beneficiary of Pentagon contract dollars. Bases overseas, contract dollars that go to building bases, running bases, supplying bases. KBR has made, by my estimate in this Tom Dispatch article, somewhere around $40 billion since around the beginning of the war in Afghanistan to build and support, maintain U.S. bases overseas. A lot of that, of course, has been to build and support bases in Iraq, but KBR makes money at bases in many parts of the world. Guantanamo Bay is another example. And they're just one of the beneficiaries, but they are the major beneficiary. They've made about five times the next closest rival on the list of Pentagon beneficiaries. In fact, one of the striking things I found in doing this accounting of how much money the United States has been spending to build and maintain, who's been benefiting from all this spending, one of the major findings I came upon was that a very small number of contractors are reaping the largest benefits. So the top 10 have secured about one-third of the $385 billion we've spent since late 2001. The top 25 have for that total. So it's a small number of often well-connected companies like KBR, like Halliburton, that have reaped literally billions of dollars to build and maintain bases overseas.
Yeah, you know, it was a game. People don't really play it that much anymore, I guess from time to time, but there was a game that people played for years and years called, why exactly did we invade Iraq anyway? And, of course, the answer was there was a lot of different reasons, none of them good enough. So that was why there was always such a debate about what got it done. But I remember at one point Juan Cole wrote a piece called The Purloined Letter that said, come on, the answer is obvious right out here in front of everyone. It was all about Dick Cheney putting Halliburton on the dole. That's it.
Yeah, as you said, it's a complicated question with many, many reasons, but I think we can't overlook the, I think in Iraq alone, it was about $37 billion that KBR earned on contracting from the Pentagon.
Mm-hmm. Well, it started back in the 90s, too, because didn't they build Camp Bondsteel in Kosovo?
That's right. The shift actually begins in the war in Vietnam. The company that KBR, its previous incarnation, was a company called Brown and Root, which actually dates back to paving roads in Texas in 1919. But in the war in Vietnam, it with a consortium of other private contractors began building bases in South Vietnam. But the real shift that does, as you said, began in the 1990s. Even prior to Kosovo, Brown and Root, still not yet Kellogg Brown and Root. Brown and Root begins building bases and supplying bases in places like Somalia, Kenya, and then most prominently and to the greatest profit in Camp Bondsteel and elsewhere in the Balkans. Mm-hmm.
And boy, you know what? If people want a picture of the American Empire, you know, if your book had been illustrated, for example, the chapter where you count the bases could have had a great picture there of Camp Bondsteel. And if anybody wants to, get a kick out of something interesting, go to your Google Images or whatever your favorite brand of search engine is and just search Bondsteel in your local image search engine and get a good bird's eye view of that thing, and that'll just blow you away. It says only one thing to me. Let's waste money.
And that's one of the other major findings in my article, that this waste and sometimes not just waste, outright fraud and abuse, that's fairly well documented, although the scope of the spending and the base network is so broad, it's really a mammoth task to try to account for all the money and account for all the waste and fraud. But there is a clear, consistent pattern of fraud at bases around the world. The Commission on Wartime Contracting, which is the commission that Congress established to look into waste and fraud and abuse in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, estimated total fraud at somewhere between $31 billion and $60 billion, truly astronomical sums. And that's just Afghanistan and Iraq. So if you look at waste and fraud and abuse worldwide, the total would be even higher.
Well, yeah, and the thing about that is, how do you make it stop once you have all those vested interests? It's sort of the same question about the entire world empire as about the Iraq war. Well, why do we even have a world empire anyway? I mean, I guess some very liberal interventionist, internationalist ideologue might say, well, collective security and keep the peace and that kind of thing, but I mean, mostly it's a puzzle to people, right? But the real answer is the vested interests of all the different people who have jobs servicing the empire, whether they're generals or whether they're contractors or whether they're selling spy equipment or whatever it is. Bombs.
No, I think that's a huge part of the answer. There are deeply entrenched vested interests, and they have created in ways that really President Eisenhower military-industrial complex speech is created a sort of self-perpetuating system that is like Frankenstein, sort of come to take on a life of its own and out of the control of any one company or one group of generals in the Pentagon. It's really a living, breathing system that we've fed with billions of dollars in Pentagon contracts and just been cut off the tap of money. There are some encouraging signs of late with sequestration and other planned budget cuts that the growth in spending, at least, is being cut off, and that there are actually some cuts. But we've got a long way to go to trim the Pentagon budget and the overall military spending down to something that is reasonable in any sense of the term.
Well, now, how many bases are there in the U.S., do you know?
About 4,500, so, around 1,000 outside the 50 states in D.C. and 4,500 within the United States, so very large collection here, too. Although it's important to point out that I think the most recent estimate is that there's excess capacity just in the United States of about 20%, so the base infrastructure here is far larger than is needed to support the number of troops the States maintains, and with planned troop reductions at home and abroad, there's really a tremendous amount of room to close bases and shrink bases both domestically and around the world.
Yeah, I mean, You know, it's almost like they expect the lost continent of Atlantis to rise up, militarize, and ready for action. I mean, what do we need 4,500 military bases to protect from? Invasion from the north? From the south? I mean, I know that there are laborers who are invading from the south, in scare quotes, right? But it's not like the Mexicans have an army they can field here or anything.
No, absolutely. You know, these bases are not primarily designed to defend the borders of the United States, and that's one of the major problems that the U.S. military, since World War II, has not been geared around defending the borders of the United States. Instead, it's been designed to maintain a global military presence with a very large and advanced, at least technologically, military. In my mind, in the minds of many, that really needs to change, especially in these times when there's so many unfunded needs in the United States and around the world, when so many people are out of work, when there are healthcare needs, housing needs, educational needs, infrastructure needs that are not being met. You know, where is all that money that's needed? So much of it has been poured into the U.S. military. And I think I'm encouraged that a growing number of people are pointing that out and demanding that we shift money from the military, from bases, from other military spending.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, they push that mythology that, you know, war is good for business. But it is, I think you're right, that it's becoming more apparent that what they really mean is, well, it's really good for Lockheed, it's really good for Halliburton, it's really good for connected businessmen, really good for lobbyists, but that doesn't mean it's good for the American people in that General Motors sense, you know what I mean?
No, that's you know, although, of course, the part of the problem is that members of Congress, anytime there's any threat that a base in their district or their state would be closed, members of Congress basically freak out. They are frightened, and rightfully so, given the realities of U.S. politics. They're frightened that they'll, you know, if a single job is lost at a base in their district or state, that they'll lose their job in Congress too. So they, you know, put aside the well-being of the country. They put aside even the, you know, well-being of any notion of national security in favor of their own interest in remaining in Congress and, to some extent, the interest of people in their district or state. Although if you look at, you know, bases in the United States and the communities surrounding them, many of them are not prosperous communities. And what we've seen is that in the wake of base closures following the Cold War, many communities, while that represented an economic blow when a base closed, many communities have actually come back stronger and rebuilt their economies stronger after a base was closed. So we really need to question the logic that a base closure or any cut to military spending is a deadly blow to our economic well-being.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's something here that I think, well, you may have mentioned it, but I think we kind of overlooked it when we were talking about the economics of it, but you have it in your article here. You know, because these companies are working with the government, most of their wrongdoing, I guess sometimes somebody gets made an example of or whatever, but most of their wrongdoing is overlooked and covered up and hushed up and ignored and that kind of thing. And not just for collecting a lot of money, for projects not completed and, you know, that sort of stuff, you know, $900 toilet seats and whatever. But also, you talk about in this section of your article here, you call a pattern of misconduct. You talk about real crimes that these contractors commit and get away with because of their closeness to the government.
No, that's absolutely right. And one of the most shocking things that I found, that these companies that have demonstrated patterns of abuse, as said, continue to get contracts. And KBR is one prominent example. DynCorp, another, which actually in the Balkans, as you mentioned, you know, has a documented history of of sex trafficking, sexual harassment, among other forms of misconduct and crime, and they just continue to get contracts. It's deeply troubling.
Yeah, Chalmers Johnson, I think. I remember reading Stars of Empire and going, wow, he's really going off about the occupations of Korea and Japan kind of overtime here, but I guess he really needed to really make that point of just, you know, Americans conceive of our soldiers as very welcome guests over there, but boy, it sure doesn't seem to feel like that to the locals when their little girls are getting raped.
No, that's sadly right. There was also a pattern which Thomas Johnson, better than anyone, documented where unfortunately bases overseas, troops again and again have committed crimes, including rape, including murder, including theft, any number of crimes. And where you see bases outside the United States, you see friction and with local communities, you see, in many cases, growing anti-American sentiment. It's really generally not been a very good way of building friendship and solidarity with people around the world.
Right. All right, now, I'm sorry we have very little time for this, but I was hoping maybe you could tell us, has there been any good news in the case of the Chagossians suing and trying to get some of their property and dignity back?
I wish I could say there was. Instead, it's actually there's been bad news in a case that they've been waiting on. There's almost a decade before the European Court of Human Rights, the Chagossians had their suit dismissed back in December, a couple days before Christmas. In fact, it was a very sad Christmas news. Which meant that the British government was victorious and has been allowed to maintain their exile. But the people are, I guess the good news is that the people are again, refusing to be defeated and will continue to wage their struggle to return to their homeland and be properly compensated for all that's been taken from them. So they are very much not giving up their struggle.
Yeah. Well, you know, the ratio between the level of injustice and the amount of publicity here is just so far out of whack, and it's just heroic the work that you've done on it. Again, the book is Island of Shame, The Secret History of the U.S. Military Base on Diego Garcia. That's something that everybody should know about. It should be on 60 Minutes every Sunday from now on until somebody cares. I don't know. But anyway, it's great work. I do hope everyone will take a look at it, and I really appreciate your time on the show again, David. Good to talk to you.
Thank you, Scott. Thanks for all your support.
All right, everybody. That is David Vine. He is an assistant professor of anthropology at American University in Washington, D.C. And again, the book is Island of Shame, The Secret History of the U.S. Military Base on Diego Garcia. And he's working on a new one about the empire of bases.
Over at AIPAC, the leaders of the Israel lobby in Washington, D.C., they're constantly proclaiming unrivaled influence on Capitol Hill. And they should be proud. The NRA and AARP's efforts make them look like puppy dogs in comparison to the campaigns of intimidation regularly run by the neoconservatives and Israel firsters against their political enemies. But the Israel lobby does not remain unopposed. At the Council for the National Interest, they put America first, insisting on an end to the empire's unjustified support for Israel's aggression against its neighbors and those whose land it occupies, and pushing back against the lobby's determined campaign in favor of U.S. attacks against Israel's enemies. CNI also does groundbreaking work on the trouble with evangelical Christian Zionism and neocon-engineered Islamophobia and drumming up support for this costly and counterproductive policy. Please help support the efforts of the Council for the National Interest to create a peaceful, pro-American foreign policy. Just go to councilforthenationalinterest.org and click Donate under About Us at the top of the page. And thanks. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. Every month, Plumline Individualist editor Sheldon Richman brings you important news and opinions on policy by heroic FFF President Jacob Hornberger, hard-hitting journalist columnist James Bovard, and others from the best of the libertarian movement. The Future of Freedom tackles the most important issues facing our country, from the bankrupt and insane welfare and regulatory states, to foreign wars and empire, the dismal state of our economy, and ongoing assaults on civil liberties. This society needs peace and freedom for prosperity to prevail. Subscribe to the Future Freedom imprint for just $25 a year or online for $15 a year at fff.org/subscribe. And hurry up, because this summer they'll be running my articles about the wars in Libya, Syria, and Somalia in the Future of Freedom too. That's fff.org/subscribe for the Future of Freedom. And tell them Scott sent you. Oh, man, I'm late. Sure hope I can make my flight.
Stand there.
Me? I am standing here.
Come here.
Okay.
Hands up. Turn around.
Whoa, easy.
Into the scanner. Ooh, what's this in your pants?
Hey, slow down. It's just my...
Hold it right there. Your wallet has tripped the metal detector. What's this? The bill of rights?
That's right. It's just a harmless stainless steel business card-sized copy of the Bill of Rights from SecurityEdition.com. They're for exposing the TSA as a bunch of liberty-destroying goons who've never protected anyone from anything. Sir, now give me back my wallet and get out of my way. Got a plane to catch.
Have a nice day.
Play a leading role in the security theater with the Bill of Rights Security Edition from SecurityEdition.com. It's the size of a business card, so it fits right in your wallet, and it's guaranteed to trip the metal detectors wherever the police state goes. That's SecurityEdition.com. And don't forget their great Fourth Amendment socks.
Hey, guys, I got his laptop.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against a depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support The Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.